It's 2014 and the Fauré family should be celebrating 150 years as hand-loomed ribbon makers in Saint-Étienne in France. Instead, they're worrying if the business will go the way of all the other ribbon-making families who didn't make it. Enter Ruth Ribicourt, wife of one of the family's descendants on his mother's side. Ruth seizes the moment and contacts an official in the French government to alert him that centuries of skill and expertise in making these exquisite ribbons were being put at risk and that no one seemed to be paying attention. The call did the trick. All of a sudden, Dior, Chanel, Valentino were all beating a path to the door. The danger receded. What's more, for the first time, the business took on a marketing manager. No prizes for guessing whom. My name's Judy Stewart and you're listening to Unpaused, a podcast for women who want to stage a career comeback after an extended break from work. This episode is part two of the story of the comeback of Ruth Ribicourt. If you haven't listened to part one of her story, you should go back and hear it first. You're in for a treat. But now, let's pick up the story at the moment when Ruth opens her husband's grandmother's box of gold and silver ribbons and the magic and her unpause begins.
I opened the box up and I had never seen anything like these ribbons. They were cut velvet, gold, heavily laden with gold and silver thread. And I was overwhelmed. And because I'd asked for this and I had made all these promises that, you know, this is what I was going to do with them. And I felt this responsibility to take them and actually now create something out of them.
Ruth, this must have been the most beautiful experience. Every time you describe that moment to me with the cardboard box and the gold and silver and velvet ribbons coming out, it sends a shiver down my spine. And I'm letting you talk because it's just such an incredible story. Well, in my brain, this is your moment of awakening. So this is the beginning of the great recovery.
It was. I mean, this is the thing. There was no strategy. This was something that was going to amuse me, making jewelry out of simple ribbons. And then it became something completely different.
But it definitely unlocked something in you. So you've got the exposure to the artist as a young woman. You've done the creative thing with cinema. You've got the marketing skills, you've got the eye, you've got a need, there's a vacuum there. You've had the big job. And obviously, given how much you love antique textiles now, there must have been something deep inside you that was stirred.
I can't explain it except for the fact that it feels like I have just connected something from a previous life because it has really taken over in a way that's not just financial business side, it's an emotional connection that I have with this. And when I realized the beauty that my family had been creating, I was just overwhelmed. And the fact that I didn't know anything about this.
Did your husband never mention this in all those years? Did it never come up?
It never came up because it's not something. So it's a fifth generation company, but my husband has never had any role in that company. And it's funny, everybody assumes that my husband works for the family company, but no, my husband laughs. He directs anyone who wants to talk about ribbons. He said, no, you need to talk to my wife. She's the ribbon woman now. Mm. So it never really was raised. And I think it's because it is a very fragile industry. I mean, it was in a serious boom in the 19th century. But since the world wars and changing fashions, one after the next, these ribbon companies have all closed. And so there's an immense sadness associated with this business. And, you know, every generation takes on this sadness. It would have been a very celebrated industry, but it's not really anymore. And I realized the extent of how incredible these ribbons were. And then the extent that I just knew nothing about this, I was like, well, I want to know more. And I think the world needs to know more. So I became this almighty pain in the butt for my family, my French family, because, you know, I was this new blow in French, they call me the pièce rapportée, the added little piece to the family. I like to call myself the valeur ajoutée, which is the added value, which I think I am. I'm not some patchwork on a quilt.
Oh, I think
I like the fact that it has textile association.
But truly, Ruth, I mean, with your background in marketing, you could see that the ribbon industry was on its last legs and yes. that there was something incredibly valuable to preserve and proclaim. And you saw it. And no doubt there were others in the family that were looking at how they could possibly revive this opportunity. But you were actually ideally placed. First, you were part of the family. Second, you had this incredible background in marketing. Third, you had the artistic genes, no doubt about that. So you went forth and worked with Uncle Julian?
Julian Four, yes.
Julian Four. So he's your husband's uncle?
He is. It's very sweet. He calls me his niece. I feel I have all those skills, which definitely serve me. But I think the biggest skill was this intense excitement, a very new energy that I was injecting into a fifth generation company. And I feel that was really the most important thing I actually brought to the table, was the desire to help and the fascination to learn, this real strong desire to make it work and to share the word with the world. Mm. I mean, I was like, how did I not know that this was a ribbon? I wanted everybody to know how incredible the craftsmanship and the skills of this company were.
You worked very hard to get the French government to really start to understand that these were industries and artisans worth protecting and skills worth preserving, et cetera, et cetera. But if we moved beyond that, how did you engage with the world of commerce at large? How did you take this 19th century company, effectively, and industry into the 21st century?
The thing that I have learned being on this adventure is that heritage companies in France traditionally do not talk about themselves. There is this unspoken rule that we don't communicate our successes, that we don't celebrate our successes, that we are, the word in French is les petites mains, the small little hands that are manufacturing. And, you know, we are not Chanel, we are not Hermès, we are just the little people in the background. The thing that's happened in the silk industry and the ribbon industry is really a multitude of factors, including fashion. Silk is no longer made in France. We have to outsource it, and the cost of labor versus Asia. So there's all those factors that are contributing to the downfall of other ribbon companies. We were struggling about 4 or 5 years ago. We were really struggling. Young fashion students, it's no longer in their vocabulary. How do we reach designers to educate them as to how our ribbons are made, why they are more beautiful than any other ribbon, and why they will essentially cost more? And
Could I just stop you there, Ruth? Could you tell me why they are more beautiful, why they are more expensive, why they are more precious?
Yes. So we are the last remaining ribbon makers in France to use Jacquard looms. My husband's grandfather, very smartly, when the needle loom was invented, all of the ribbon makers immediately rushed to get rid of their old looms to bring in this needle loom, which was so much faster, so much more efficient. And yet Raphael, my husband's grandfather, kept his looms and actually started to buy pieces of looms from all the other makers that were getting rid of their looms. It might have seemed backward at the time to not jump on the needle loom bandwagon, but essentially that is really what has saved us, because the Jacquard loom creates a ribbon which is so much more luxurious, so much more detailed, where the needle loom is so much faster, but you are simply not getting the quality of ribbon that you get with the Jacquard loom. The Jacquard loom can only make 6 meters per day. It's a very slow, intricate, luxury craft. And the needle loom, I mean, you just press the button and it keeps going, and it makes the ribbon as many, you know, I think it's 10 to 15 times more. It's a much faster, but less less detailed process. And so haute couture designers, they know you can, when you hold the ribbons up side by side, you can distinctly see the difference in the quality. A loom that makes only 6 meters a day versus a needle loom that's making vast amounts more, that the quality of the product and the price of the product is going to be very different. The other thing about our factory, it's not about pressing a button and walking away. There is an incredible amount of human skill needed to operate these jacquard looms. The first time I stepped onto the floor of the ribbon factory, I was overwhelmed. I mean, I'm quite an emotional person anyway, but I felt a lump in my throat, and it's all of the senses are on alert when you're on in the atelier. You've got the beautiful clacking of the navettes, which are kind of the shuttles, which are kind of hitting off each other. You've got the smell of the oil of the to oil the cogs of the machines. You've got all these incredible colored silk threads and cotton threads on bobbins. And then you have the workers on the floor, many of whom are many generations working for our family company. And they're nearly like musicians when you see them knotting and tying the threads by hand. It's an incredible sensation to be on that floor. So it's not just a machine element. It's human. It's history. It's heritage. It's a family enterprise, which, you know, generations have passed through these doors. And I think what I've heard about our family company is that it was a very personal company, because also in the day they were so busy, they used to outsource a lot of the ribbons. And in Saint-Étienne, a lot of the homes would actually have looms inside their homes. So my husband's grandfather, his name is Georgie, he would go to check up on how the ribbons were coming along, and he'd go in for an omelette in so-and-so's house, and then he'd go up the road for a glass of wine in the other person's house. And when he passed away, there was this incredible crowd of passementiers in Saint-Étienne that turned out for his funeral. So nearly all of Saint-Étienne at one point were making ribbons. Some of the houses you can see were custom built to accommodate these looms. It's an intoxicating business to be involved in. And I really, as you say, I feel like this was the moment that kind of unlocked everything for me, was taking on this family pride and really wanting to share it with the world. I was the annoying Irish woman who was obsessed with ribbons, who always wanted to come visit the factory and had all these incredibly insane ideas as to who we could collaborate with and what we should be doing. He eventually came around to the idea that, you know, that I should look after communications for the company, because I really, it's all I do is talk about how incredible the company is. And so to formalize that, I launched their Instagram account. And I mean, what is fascinating is that they had never celebrated their successes up until that moment when the Instagram was launched. There was no platform where people could see in a live way the new ribbon collections, the ribbons as they appeared on the catwalk adorning a Chanel outfit. Or we were just recently, a lot of our ribbons were used in the Dries Van Noten Christian Lacroix show. So I think it's really important to educate people as to how the ribbons can be used. But also then I love to show videos of the ribbons being woven in Saint-Étienne. This is what it looks like. This is what it sounds like. This is why this is a beautiful ribbon. So it's a part education, part celebration. We know that a lot of young designers are now on Instagram, and this is something we have our phones with us 24 hours a day. So at the big shows, rather than direct people to a website, which often in many cases is just like a window dressing, you know, there's no news, no updates, there's no sense of interaction with the company as well. So it puts a human element into the company that you just don't have with a website that is stagnant.
Ruth, I want to ask you though, how do you handle the questions about being copied? Is there this great fear that by putting it out there and sharing your expertise and the milestones that others will copy you, and especially people who will be ripping off your ideas? How do you deal with that?
Well, that is definitely one of the main reasons why these manufacturers have not communicated up until now, is this deep-rooted fear of being copied. Mm. Because, yes, something can be turned around very quickly in Asia now. I suppose either you hide away and nobody knows about you, or you get out there and you share and people discover you. So the difference is anybody can take one of our ribbons and make a very cheap copy of that, but they cannot make the same ribbon that we create simply because the technology is not there. It's simply not something that they can recreate thread for thread. So that is something that we have an advantage on. We have over 40,000 designs in our archives that are only our designs. And we also have the archives of six of the greatest ribbon makers that ever existed in Saint-Étienne. So we have a huge creative resource, but we do regularly patent designs. So there is still a, you know, designers that want to work with a quality product, and they know that you will only get that by working on the Jacquard loom. So some people wouldn't know the difference. I know that I definitely wouldn't know the difference about 12 years ago, but there are certain designers that still want to seek out that really beautiful, beautiful ribbon. And so it is an issue, but I don't think it's our biggest issue, really.
No, it's a conversation that I'd like to have, because the tension that you describe between being completely closed but therefore protective of what you've created and putting it out there is something that applies at very many levels of
absolutely
of life. Obviously, you're running a very important commercial enterprise, and so it's important to use all the legal tools that you have at your disposal to protect your intellectual property. But in relation to someone who's putting their toe in the water and has something to offer, there just comes a point where you have to say, look, this is what I've made, or this is what I've done, or this is my idea, and it's got my signature on it. And I think that if your brand stands for quality, there will always be someone who will say, yes, I know I can get it elsewhere, but actually I want to do it with her. I want to be at her board table. I want to hear her talk. I want to read her book. I want to follow her Instagram. Whatever it is, you just have to be prepared to take a deep breath sometimes and say, copy away.
Well, yes, and I do see that fear amongst artists and creatives. There is this idea of the absolute fear of putting something that they've spent hours and days and weeks creating. But I think, you know, if you are genuinely talented, this is not the only idea you're going to have. And as you say, I think people want to connect with the human. They would rather buy it from you than buy the rip-off version printed on a t-shirt by some big multinational company.
Hmm. And I think that that's well documented around the world. You know, it's why luxury goods still have a huge audience and market. You can always buy a cheap ripoff of something, but there are people who will still pay a premium to get the real thing, which is made by craftsmen in the authentic way, by hand, etc., etc.
I do also see a huge movement on Instagram, in the community side of Instagram, to protect artists and to be, you know, there's a lot of, I'm trying to think, the first one, Diet Prada is one specific space on Instagram that calls out designers that rip off other young designers and young creatives. And so I think there's, yes, you're exposing yourself, but there's also much more transparency, and people will really not be afraid to call you out on something. With Instagram, you can very clearly see and put side by side something and say, well, what do you think? Is there plagiarism here or counterfeiting? I think it's something that has to be embraced, because we need to communicate. Mm. We're sharing the stories behind how something is made. We're sharing the humans in the atelier. And this is not an anonymous big factory. This is where people who are trained for generations are working. And I think that's the way forward, is to celebrate the human stories. And I think when people connect with the human behind a creation, then they make that connection as to why the price is the way it is. It's a really, really important.
It brings the whole thing to life.
Exactly.
I could talk about this absolutely all day, in case you can't tell. want to bring you to the French Muse because it seems to me that in running these experiential retreats, which are focused on the textiles, the foraging, the feasting, the photography, all of these things, it seems to me that you're bringing so much of what you've been through full circle. So many of your core beliefs about sharing the human stories, the handmade things, the artisan craftsmanship, so many things in an environment where people can actually get to experience the life and lifestyle that you've embraced in Provence for themselves. It seems to me, I can hear the way that the ribbon chapter has really animated you and got you out of that hole. But this next chapter of the French Muse really starts to tie all of these threads together. Can you talk to me about how the French Muse started and also how you did it? Because I think that you are the perfect person to talk about getting a project that is really yours alone off the ground.
So we moved to France in the winter. I discovered this whole side of French heritage ribbon making, which then led me on to discover other elements such as lace making and the Les Indiennes, the 18th century fabrics, and into natural dyeing. And then it opened up this whole world of the brocante in France, which is every weekend there is an incredible array, like a living museum laid out in villages across France every Saturday and Sunday. And so I started to discover and to learn about handmade, beautiful textiles and papers and art and paintings. And in doing that, I connected with some incredible people, self-taught collectors, artists that would create with textiles and old papers. And my whole world took on this whole new direction, an incredibly nourishing and enriching direction of just having my eyes opened for the first time to all of these skills and art forms that I just knew nothing about. And in doing that and making these friendships, you know, I would be invited inside French homes, which are notoriously very, very private. And I would see how some of my favorite artists would live, how they would create with textiles, how they would design their homes with antiques. And the experience of living for a few years, I would spend my days driving around the countryside and meeting people and just exploring and stepping deeper into the creative side of Provence. I think about 3 or 4 years ago, I started my first Instagram account. And I was really nervous about doing that because I didn't know what I wanted to share. But when I started to share these experiences and the artists' homes and the beauty, I just had never really lived or stepped into that before up until moving to Provence. And I wanted to share that. And the response took me by surprise on Instagram. And I very quickly got connected with some really key editors and design bloggers across the world who started to champion me. And I started to feel like this idea, would anybody be interested in having me bring them around Provence and sharing all of these incredible things that I had experienced that expanded my world and my universe. And the response was, yes, this is something that we would like to do. And so it was Christmas that I started to build the website. And at the time I was working with a fantastic collaborator who's a really, really gifted antiques dealer. And when we floated the idea out there on the internet, you know, who would be interested in this, we immediately had a group sign up. And so it took the idea of the French Muse from something that was a concept and a dream, and then it became reality because the need was there.
And Ruth, before you put it out there, did you agonize over it? Did you perfect it? Or did you just sort of float the idea just to test the water?
Yeah, I would have pages and pages and pages of ideas and potential names. And I was so excited to do this. At the time, I knew what I didn't want to do. And that was I didn't want to be one of those people with a flag and 30 people trailing behind me. there is nothing intimate about that. I knew that what I wanted was a small group situation where I could give everybody my absolute attention and make them feel, I suppose, loved and looked after and nurtured. You can connect with people. And so so I knew that I wanted it to be small groups. I also knew that if it's a small group, I can actually, to some degree, make it a bespoke experience, asking them what is on your bucket list to do and what are your passions and your interests. And then it's really, really important for me to connect the right artists with the right group of guests, because being an artist myself, I know what it's like to have somebody come into your creative space. When someone walks in and gives you this incredible boost of energy, it doesn't have to be a transaction, but if there's that exchange, that is a transformative thing for an artist and a creative. So I wanted to also support these creatives in Provence and give them that feedback and basically create a community. There is this sense of a community that has been created that continues. And that is really wonderful for me. It's mostly women that come on my trips, solo travelers and also groups of friends. And I feel at the end of the weeks, there have been several women who have broken down and cried because it's been emotionally charged. Mm. And I do think that there are certain experiences that are not, they're more than jumping on and off a bus. You know, they are transformative and nourishing, and they replenish us with beauty that kind of keep us going. They charge our batteries up for the next tough months ahead when, you know, life isn't so beautiful.
And Ruth, I must say, I definitely got a sense that there were women searching for a way to make a transition, either from a pause to an unpause, or from something that they don't love, they're looking for a different way, perhaps a more creative life, especially professional women. There was definitely a sense when I was there on that program that there were women there looking for something that would give them a deeper sense of satisfaction and something richer.
You came for my second Forage Feast photography, and it was kind of crazy how it happened. I just knew that I wanted to celebrate nature in Provence and the bounties of nature in winter, which are the black truffle, and to bring people around the table of all different age groups, all different nationalities and backgrounds and stages in life. And that was how the idea came about to create the Forage Feast Photography Retreat. And I really do feel, as you say, changing careers at all ages. And in July, we had our youngest guest was 29 and our oldest guest was in her 70s, and everybody brought something completely different to the table, and it's quite surreal. At one point I stood back and I looked at all these women at the table sharing stories. I had this bizarre feeling that, wow, this is what I'm meant to be doing. Something that I really love is connecting people. That is something essentially it makes me the happiest, is when I can connect people and create opportunities for collaboration and support and lift women up. That's at the core of everything I do. The more I look back at that's how all of my different kind of jobs kind of feed into each other. It is essentially about supporting creatives and women and giving them a voice. That's essentially what happened to me when I moved here, was some women on Instagram reached out virtually and said, we believe in you. We think what you're doing is really worth it and really important. And we want to see more. When you have those cheerleaders in your life, that's actually in French, they call it your pom-pom girls. I think we do need to have that support network. And it doesn't have to be a friend from childhood. It can be somebody across the ocean who says, I just love what you're doing. And I'm here for you. And that is what I've seen, the idea of the circle and feeding into the circle and how all these opportunities just keep going round and the circle gets bigger. And it's not about getting to the top of some pyramid and scrambling over people to get there, but to feed in and lift others up as we were lifted up. And I think that's at the core of what I do.
I think it's at the core of what you do too, Ruth. And I think that you are perfectly positioned to do that. What I particularly found fascinating about that program was that you didn't just have the guests and focus on them. You saw that it was very important for them to also engage directly with the artistic community that you had befriended. And you brought in different artists, a ceramicist, the woman who did those beautiful wire sculptures that were then illuminated and that you set in the garden, the girl who made the beautiful plates, the girl who did the incredible screen printing of this silk and made those into those beautiful dresses. And you thought it was important for us to actually have the exchange with them. And I think that you became the facilitator of that because it's actually a window into your life, that's the life that you lead and that you were able to share that. I think you are doing what you were meant to do, Ruth. And it may not be what you're meant to do forever, but I think that you are definitely where you need to be. And it will be very interesting to see where this goes. If you had one piece of advice to give to others who find themselves in the abyss that you described, what would be the big thing that you would say to them? What's the one thing that you think was the most important catalyst for your recovery?
Well, I think leaving a work environment that I was in with Walt Disney, for example, where there is a system of merits, you get regular feedback and performance reviews. When you leave that system and nobody's kind of saying, oh, well done, you did a great job at being a mother, or, you know, oh, that dinner you made, it was phenomenal, I'm giving you a pay rise. I think I did feel I was entirely on my own. And so looking back, I think without knowing what I was doing, I started to do lots of workshops online. I self-taught little things that kind of boost your confidence and, you know, teach you that you're okay, that you're really capable. I think kind of building up your confidence again. And that was what worked for me. This idea that actually, you know what, I can do that. I'm really good at that. And I also think trusting yourself and just constantly being open to the idea of learning. Those are two elements that really worked for me. And I could never have imagined this adventure 10 years ago and everything that I've learned since and how all these kind of jigsaw puzzle pieces kind of fit into each other now. And at the time, they all seemed so disconnected, but they are now all coming together to fit into a bigger picture. I think if I was to rewind 10 years, I would tell myself to just not be so hard on myself, slow down and just trust and just never stop learning.
You are an inspiration. There's no doubt about you. There are many lessons to be found in Ruth's story. For instance, you don't have to be forever defined by your first degree or job. Ruth used her business and marketing skills to pursue the world of art and textiles that she discovered and came to love. Once she got to that point where these two sides of her brain were in harmony, there was no resistance, and away she went. The second thing is the importance of ongoing learning. There's never been a better time to be open to educating yourself and expanding your knowledge. It's all there for the asking, and usually free of charge. Learning new skills gives you confidence. It's evidence that you're capable and a self-starter, and it displaces the narrative that you're not okay. This really worked for Ruth. Finding out how things were made, who made them, who appreciated their value, how they were used, were all early signposts to what would become the French Muse, the business that she created to follow. When Ruth analyzes what's at the core of what she does, she visualizes a circle rather than a pyramid. She believes that once you make a start with something that makes sense to you, the circle of opportunities gets bigger. You don't have to scramble over someone else and crush them to achieve your goals. There's never just one idea. Unpaused is produced by Leonie Marsh and recorded by Jason Milhouse. Thanks also to Ruth Rippacore for telling me the story of her life. I suspect she has another story about the silk industry in France, but that's for another day. You can stay up to date with all of our Unpaused stories on our website, unpaused.net, or by following our Instagram account at _unpaused. We also love hearing from you and getting your thoughts on the show, so please leave a comment on Instagram or tag us in your stories and posts. Or go to the Unpaused website and leave a voice recording with any questions or comments you may have. I'm Judy Stewart. Stay tuned for the next episode.